The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and I work here in author events. And one of the coolest parts of my job is getting to be here to introduce writers that I love, people like Daniel Clowes. Celebrated graphic novelist and Academy Award-nominated screenwriter Daniel Clowes is the multiple Harvey Ignatz Award-winning creator of the alternative comic 8-Ball. His many graphic novels include Like a Velvet Glove, Cast in Iron, David Boring, My One True Love, I love that book, Wilson, and The Death Ray. His illustrations have appeared in such varied places as a Yo Latingo album cover, Cracked Magazine, National Lampoon Magazine, on skate decks for Santa Cruz Skateboards, in Vogue, a Ramones video, The Village Voice, and curiously, on a Gen X-inspired soda can. His work was adapted by director Terry Zwigoff into the acclaimed and popular films Ghost World and Art School Confidential. Newsweek called tonight's author the country's premier underground cartoonist, and The New Yorker, for whom he is a frequent cover artist, named him a bona fide cult hero, as I'm sure he is to many of you. His new graphic novel is called Patience. I don't know really what I can say about it, except that it's a psychedelic science fiction love story veering from violent destruction to deeply personal tenderness. It's also a hell of a lot of fun so far. Interviewing Daniel tonight is Sam Brigger. Sam is the father of two lovely children. More importantly, he is the books producer for the NPR show Fresh Air with Terry Gross. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Daniel Clowes and Sam Brigger to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Hello.
Thanks very much.
So, what are we showing?
I'll be showing some images. You know most of them. So
I don't need to look.
So, Dan, your new book is about love and revenge, and the backbone of it is time travel. What inspired you to do something about time travel?
Well, I didn't want to do anything about time travel. I wanted to use time travel sort of as a metaphor or as a way to kind of explore the idea of going through your life, hitting these little points in your life that are, you know, like a flow chart where you go off in different directions and then something else happens and you go in another direction and then all of a sudden you're way over here when you started here and you're a very different person from what you were there. And so the idea of time travel where you can kind of examine this person that you were back here when you're down the road here and see, like, how the hell did that happen? That's what, because I'd spent a long time prior to working on this putting together an exhibition of my work, old work, and a monograph that went with it. And that entailed digging through drawers and looking at all my early work and kind of all the stuff that I deeply repress both in my own mind and, like, physically into drawers in my house and never look at. And to sort of have to grapple with that and go like, oh, I was this guy, and now I'm this guy, based on these like three random events in my life that kind of took me to this point, and it struck me as something that was, you know, that would keep me interested in a story for 5 years.
Well, thinking about that earlier version of you, I mean, have you thought about whether that person would recognize you now, what they would think about your career?
I think about that a lot. I think what would I look at myself and go, oh man, he's bald with a beard. That's so depressing. I would have been sad about that, I think. And I would have thought, oh, his eyes have gone, you know. I had perfect vision back then.
Well, what about your career?
His posture is still bad.
Well, you sit up a little bit. What about in terms of your career? with that person?
No, I would have been like, oh my God, like how did that happen? I was expecting to, you know, work for Cracked Magazine for 4 years and then, you know, try to get work putting up aluminum siding or something.
Yeah.
Doing my prison drawings while I was, you know, down for a DUI.
Well, hopefully, I'm glad that things have worked out better than you thought they were going to go.
Yeah.
So you worked on this book for 5 years?
Pretty much, yeah.
Is it kind of scary to have it come out after all that time?
It's very weird. Monday was the first day anybody read it. You know, it's been sent around to a few, you know, people I know, friends, and my publisher obviously read it, but nobody out in the, you know, the great masses has actually seen it. And so it's sort of up until that point, I can live in the illusion that, like, yeah, it's good, you know, it works. And then now I get to hear, like, I don't really like this part, or, you know, everybody likes this one thing, but not this other thing. And,
right. Well, you actually didn't show it to your wife either, right?
When I say I don't show it to anybody, it doesn't mean I'm, like, you know, putting a black cloth over the, you know, it's like, can't enter this room. People see it, you know, they see the artwork. I mean, it's on my drawing board. My wife could just get up earlier than me and go look at it, you know, so be easy enough. But I don't let anybody read it, you know. I mean, she could obviously read it if she wanted to, but she knows to respect that, you know. And it's mainly just because I don't want any tiny sign of discouragement. You know, I would, any like little, just like, that's great. I'd be like, what was that? What was the little head nod? It's, you know, it's better to live in the complete delusional fantasy that everything's fine.
Everything's perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you've said that you had this dispiriting experience where you'd worked on a book for a year and you're at an author signing event and then someone in line reads it while they're in line and they've finished it.
Oh, yeah. No, with the early comics, you know, they were like 30 pages, and I had many times where, you know, I'd have a line and I was signing and I'd see somebody, I'll get one of these and get it signed, and they would be in the line reading it, you know, and they'd get to the end and it would be like, why do I need this? You know, I'm done with this. And they'd put it back. And I once I was at some event at a comic book store, and I saw a guy come in who was sort of like a superhero guy, and he had dragged his girlfriend in, who obviously didn't care at all about comics. This was many years ago. And she was sort of looking around, and she saw Ghost World, and she said, oh, look at this. And she opens it to the middle, and she starts reading, and she reads all the way to the end. And meanwhile, her boyfriend is, you know, I don't know what he's wasting his time with. And then she gets to the end, and she goes, She goes back to the beginning and reads, and then she reads up to the point where she started. And I was like, I've found another reader. And then she just puts it back and walks away. That was something I shouldn't have seen.
Well, it's a good thing you've made this one a little heftier than maybe.
That's right. Maybe she'd hurt herself trying to put it back.
So a lot of movies and comics start often with like this establishing shot, which is often like wide angle. It's of a street scene or a house, and it pans in or it focuses in on some of the characters. I want you to describe the establishing shot of your new comic. So the top left
this.
There. Yeah, you chose an interior scene.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's funny because a lot, like the New Yorker put this on their website, and I think they had no idea what that was.
You know, it took me a while. I was looking at it very closely, and I was like, oh!
Yeah.
Okay.
I always like the idea of starting a story with, like, the conception of a character, you know, just that moment. It seemed like that's just boom, you're there. It would be great in a movie, too, to have just, like, x-ray footage.
Yeah, well, maybe when you adapt this, you can do that. This book, like the last two books you've done, Mr. Wonderful and Wilson, are a lot about people trying to create relationships in their lives, to have some sort of family, and it's sort of more in the domestic sphere. These books are things that you've written since your son was born, is that right?
Yeah. Yes.
So what has been interesting you about sort of more of a domestic story?
Well, you know, it's obvious you have no idea how that's going to affect you to have a child. And I resisted having kids for a long time because I was terrified it would affect me. And I thought, I'm going to try to like get through this without having, you know, without even noticing that little brat in the other room. But, you know, the minute you're sort of faced with that responsibility, you find out things about yourself that you maybe didn't want to face. You know, you find out what your true opinions are. You know, I find that when I'm talking in front of my son, I find I try to say like what I really feel rather than some version of myself I would have had in my 20s where I had mm-hmm. some pose that was just, you know, I want to be contrary because of this various thing. You know, it was much more, I want him to know like what I actually really feel and like what are my real values. And you find yourself kind of really like, do I believe in this? And is this an actual, you know, opinion of mine, or is this just some masked, you know, thing I'm trying to put out to the world? And so I found it was like very profound in that way that you know, I sort of became more myself in a certain way. And then you also have that thing of where you know, before that I thought of myself as like, you know, you always think like, I would take a bullet for my best friend or for my wife or something. And then you think like, yeah, if the gun was pointed at me, I'm not sure about that. Like I'd probably be like, you know, I'd say, you know, I've got a lot to do here, you know, maybe not me. And then, you know, but the idea of like protecting your child, you really do know, like I would like, you know, carry a bear carcass through the Ozarks and with my teeth to, you know, what it's like, you would just do whatever it took. And it's a very different feeling. And that's sort of the kind of the one-dimensional nature of the guy's quest in this book that was sort of coming out of that.
Do you think that that desire, when you're around your son, to be honest as you can be, has that translated into your work?
I think so, because I think I then just, you know, sort of synthesize that and think, you know, what do I really think?
And so does that also, is that part of the reason why your books have become longer and you
that
have...
I don't know. I mean, they haven't necessarily become longer. They're kind of all over the map.
Okay.
I mean, I think a lot of my early works are about that idea of identity or trying to figure out who you are. Certainly Ghost World is about that and mm-hmm. The Death Ray a little bit. And I think the later books are more about, like, I know who I am now and it's about that. You know, it's about sort of facing that.
So you've said in past interviews that when you were a kid, a science fiction comic had a big influence on you. It was Strange Adventures, number 161.
That's right.
Which is, here it is. This
I
is
can't
a
explain why.
Hermetically sealed version of it, which you could buy because it's a...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 9.4. That's the best image I could find online. But what was it about this image that concerned you so?
I can't begin to explain it. I was so upset by this. It was before I could read. And I remember my brother had it, and I remember looking at it for like an hour and just the thought that like, the world was so hot and yet you couldn't drink seemed... I remember getting so upset that I banged my head against the wall until my mom was like, what are you doing? And I was like, look at this comic. Like, look at this. I was so upset.
So
it still upsets me. It feels like it's, you know, it's more prescient than ever.
Well, I think you've also said that this had some... There were some concerns about family life that you noticed in this cover too.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. The poor kid.
Well, your character Patience expresses a lot of anxiety about being a parent.
I guess I thought the TV announcer guy was the dad, you know, and it's like he's holding a stick and he's going to kill his mother or something. I would always read into the... It was always like, oh, that... You know, there'd be like a girl kissing a horse, and I'd be like, the horse is eating her face.
So you just needed to be a little older to get the content.
The imagery in those old comics was so demented that you just assume everything was like...
It's like an easy
misanthropic comic, and yeah. Like, you know, just depicting the hidden inner life of the world that was horrifying, you know, behind the curtain.
Well, you said your character Patience, who's the main character, the main character in the couple, expresses a lot of concern about being a parent, and there's this great image. I think my favorite image from the book. If you can see, this is Jack and Patience lying in bed, and if you look around the room, it's a very frightening scene. How did you come? You can see there's faces in the covers, and there's demons on the shade. There's a creepy-looking guy in a window across the street. How did you come up with this? Do you have a busy mind at night?
I have terrible insomnia, and I'm always lying in bed. From childhood on, I was seeing, you know, weird faces in the lace. We have like these lace curtains, and I just cannot unsee these demonic faces staring at me in the bedroom. And I actually have to remove stuff from the bedroom, so it's just completely nothing in there.
So it's all two-dimensional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this, you know, this is sort of a worst-case scenario of how I would just see. And you see, earlier in the book, you do see the room and see that it's not like this at all.
It's not terrifying.
Right.
Yeah. So your narrators have also had busy minds when they're often walking around thinking a lot to themselves. Is that characteristic of how you sort of walk around the world?
I suppose so. I mean, does anybody walk around and not think about anything?
Well, I think some people's minds are maybe busier than others, but really? I guess you haven't been.
Wonder about that often. Yeah. Sometimes you imagine people don't have any thoughts at all, and you think, how can that be?
Part of this book gets into metaphysics a little bit, and this one character, Jack, is trying to figure out his place in the world, and there's some great imagery about sort of dealing with time and space and interdimensionality, I guess you would say. You had open heart surgery in 2006. Was that part of the reason why this book with that?
Because I was on some kind of drugs or something.
No, but in terms of just, I mean, he's reckoning with his place in the world.
I did have a moment at that time where I thought, like, well, this might be it, and I, you know, how do I feel about that?
Yeah.
And I was sort of weirdly like, well, it's okay. I'll be all right. You know, I felt bad, but I was sort of like, yeah, you know, I probably won't do anything good after this anyway.
Do you think this is a change in terms of things that you've approached in the past work that you've done?
I don't know, maybe. The idea with this was I got really interested in finding old self-published pamphlets where people have metaphysical theories, and they always have charts where it's like the Enlightenment and the Great Reasoning and all, you know, they just have all this stuff that somehow makes sense to them in a completely insane cross-reference chart, and it's almost so uniform that you feel like they do actually all see something that they're depicting in almost the same way. I mean, I have dozens of these, and they're very similar, so I was trying to capture the crackpot metaphysics chart and somehow make it seem plausible. I wanted to sort of ratify their crazy images by making it seem like a real thing.
Does this image make sense to you logically?
It actually does. It's actually very worked out in a way that makes perfect sense, which now that I see it makes me deeply concerned about that Child Protective Services are raiding my house right now.
Your character Jack has an epiphany in this book, and it's not uncommon for your characters like Wilson or Enid from Ghost World to have revelatory moments. But you kind of keep what actually happens to them off panel. You don't really describe what's going on in their head. That's on purpose, I'm assuming, and if so, why?
Maybe it's just because I didn't get it across very well. I sort of feel like I've showed as much as I could possibly show without making it too explicit.
You're not trying to make it didactic?
I absolutely don't want to say something. I don't want to make a point or say, if you do this, you'll have an epiphany, or this is why he had an epiphany. I want you to... It's got to be part of the story. I mean, it's sort of like I want it to feel like just a natural occurrence. You know, it's just like watching a when you hear thunder and you wait and you want to see the lightning bolt. You know, it's, I want it to have that kind of a feeling.
Jack Barlow, the main character, one of the other main characters in the book, he is traveling through time, and at one point he asks someone at a bar, if you had the chance to kill Hitler's mom, would you do it? And the guy who's watching football, he says, I might after I go break Dan Marine's arm yesterday. So, and a lot of the book is about, part of the book is about personal motivations and versus civic duty when right. you have a certain right. power like this. Why was that interesting to you?
Actually, the reason I put in that line was just sort of an in-joke, was a few years ago I was interviewed for a magazine, a British magazine, one of the big daily papers, and I can't remember which one. And they have a column that's very much like the one that used to be on the back page of the New York Times magazine, you know, where they ask somebody very short questions and have very short answers. And so I did it all by email, and this woman asked me, you know, if you could go back in time, what would you do? And I wrote, if, you know, I'd like to say I would go back and maybe kill Hitler as a baby or find out if Jesus was actually a divine being, but probably I would just go back to my old neighborhood and like look around and, you know, see the kids I grew up with. And I later learned that when they print these in this magazine, they just cut it down to the bare minimum. And so it said, what would you do if you could go back in time? And it goes, I would kill Hitler.
Well, you actually have your character, Jack, go back to his old neighborhood.
Yeah, that's what, after I, you know, articulated that, I realized that that's sort of the, that's kind of what the story's about in many ways.
Have you done that yourself?
Oh, yeah. My mom still lives in the same house I grew up in, so it's easy.
Is that an enjoyable experience?
No.
No.
It's fraught with emotional peril, I will say.
But one that, is it edifying in some way?
Oh, yeah. I'm a grown man. I can take it. But it's quite something to see, sort of. It's like my mom has a lot of stuff in the house, and it's sort of like I can still see my stuff kind of under all the stuff. Like it's like my childhood is preserved under old newspapers
under layers.
And stuff. Yeah.
Do you still have a room there? What's your
room
become?
Sort of. I mean, there is a room that I used to live in that's now filled with auto parts.
With auto parts?
Yeah. My mom ran a garage in Chicago for years.
But she still has the auto parts.
She has the parts, not the garage.
Not the garage anymore.
My mom is now, she's 86 and she's a lawyer. She got her law degree when she was 76, I think.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, she is an amazing person.
Is she practicing?
Yeah. She does elder law, not surprisingly.
One thing I've noticed about your comics over the years is that the speech balloons have, in a lot of panels, been drifting off the page.
Yeah.
And so you can't actually read what the people are saying. How did you come up with that and why?
It's one of those things that just sort of happens by necessity. I started with that Mr. Wonderful book. And with the idea was that I wanted the book to be all inside his head. So you see his thoughts, and they're always in the foreground. And whatever anybody else is saying is covered up by those thoughts. So it's sort of the way that we normally are talking to each other, where we're thinking about, like, I really got to go, and somebody is telling us something, and we're not focusing.
Right.
I wanted to capture that. And I like the way it worked. I just liked the idea that it left, it showed the intention of leaving something to your imagination, and it left it, for you to fill in. I do have lots of people who write and go, what were the words in this one?
You know, oh, really?
What are they saying?
Yeah. Do you know what they're saying?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, to make it look right, I have to write the whole thing.
Oh, you write it
looks
out
weird.
On the side.
Yeah. But it's often just totally made up. It's not like I copy edit the missing words or anything. Yeah.
So this book is highly plotted, I think more so than some of your previous work. Did you have to really set the structure out ahead of time more than other things you've done?
Well, yeah. I didn't think I could just wing a time travel story. Yeah. You know, it's a, I was very concerned with... I didn't want anybody to read the book and have everything that I'm really interested in work, all the relationships and the motivations and the characters. They're like, oh, those were great, but it doesn't make sense. You know, the time travel thing doesn't make sense. I wanted that to be all the questions answered, and you don't have to, you know, concern yourself with that, because that's not really what the story is about. So I had to make sure that was as figured out as it could possibly be. And it really took the entire 5 years to get it so every little thing kind of added together. And you find little connections along the way. It's a good process to work that long for something like that.
Did you like working like that?
Kind of, yeah. It kind of takes your... It frees your mind to do the more creative stuff, because you have to use a part of your brain on this kind of nuts and bolts thing, and then all of a sudden you find you're able to kind of think about the more creative aspects without the without this, you know, that part of your brain kind of, you know, making your creative decisions more logical or something. It's like your logical brain is used for something that requires logic.
So you're like plotting out the specific points you have to hit, and then in between those moments you can work on the
right
relationship between the characters.
Right. I always hate when people compare anything to jazz, but it is, that's very similar to how it is in a way, where you have a theme and you have an sort of a structure that you kind of go back to, but you can go off in all different directions along that theme.
Fantagraphics recently reprinted in a 2-volume set the first 18 issues of 8-Ball.
Yes.
You were very much involved in that. Was it enjoyable to look back at all that work? I mean, I know you've already done it for that, the show that you were mentioning before, but...
You know, I find there's sort of a lag time. If something is just a few years old, it makes me cringe. You know, I look at it and go, oh my God, this is a disaster. And if it's like 10 years old, I'm sort of, well, it's, you know, I was a young man. And this stuff seems so old, it's like, I was very forgiving of it. And I had to really like look back and go like, well, I worked really hard. You know, I remember working all the time, every day, all day, doing this stuff and trying to learn to do this, you know, do that kind of artwork. And it required like real tenseness on my part, you know. It was very difficult.
Did you have a desire to change anything or fix things that you thought were a problem at all? I mean, I know you've done that.
No.
when you've taken old stories and then had them come out again as a...
Yeah, this is, you know, the warts and all. In fact, there was an issue of Ghost World where the colors were printed in orange instead of blue for some reason. It was just that we were all like, why did that happen?
Right.
Nobody ever will find out. And I was like, no, we got to do the orange. It's got to be the orange Ghost World, you know,
because that's
how I saw it. I wanted it to be how I saw it the first time. But we did sort of, you know, digitally remaster everything, which means we had to get the original art back from collectors and things like
that. Right, because you sold a lot of it, right?
Oh, yeah, I used to sell everything for no money. And my dear friend Alvin Buenaventura, who helped me with this, who just passed away a few weeks ago, did this amazing sleuthing work where he would find a collector who had sold it to another collector who had then traded it at an auction, who sold it to a comic store, who sold it to the... And he would somehow find these pieces and then con the people into sending us the artwork so we could scan it. So...
And then we'd
happen to lose it in the mail.
Yeah.
No, we weren't good about it. But it was, you know, it was... Because a lot of the stuff was... We just had no way to print it except the blurry comics, you know, and I didn't want to do that.
What was sort of the most surprising or fun thing about looking back at these issues?
I mean, I was really down on myself during that era. I was really always trying, like, I got to get better. And then looking back on them, I sort of was forgiving myself. I was like, you know, you did a good job. These are pretty good. And they're dense, and they're, you know, I always felt like I gave the readers their money's worth. You know, they were $3 or whatever, and I would kill myself for those issues, you know.
How long would it take to make an issue. I mean, you did everything.
I think the comic was supposed to be quarterly, and it was always like 9 months per issue. It's hard to make a living on a $3 comic that came out once a year. But
and you did all the lettering yourself, too.
I did everything. I did everything there could be done.
Do you still letter by hand?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Well, I know a lot of people use computers.
I don't approve of that. I can tell a mile away, and it always...
Really?
It's, I feel like I'm reading a robot going like, and then I will go.
Well, I always thought it amazing, too, that you did the lettering, but also the font you used was very elaborate, too. Like, the narration always had these, I don't know what you call it, but these little flourishes. Yeah, the serifs on it.
Yeah.
That didn't drive you crazy doing this?
I could do it very quickly, yeah.
Really?
I'm a professional.
All right, well, I have to ask you about one image from
8-Ball.
And this is an image that has traumatized me for years. This is from like a Velvet Glove cast in iron. And above, that's Tina, who is part mutant fish, part human, I think, trying to seduce our hero, Clay Loudermilk. And I think... I've always interpreted it as that she's dropped her eggs on the bed and she's hoping he's going to inseminate.
Well, duh.
Why did you do this to me? How did this image come up in your mind?
I was trying, you know, at the time I was like, how did I come up with Tina? And then I was, when I finally got the internet, you know, whenever that was, 1998 or something, I was looking at old episodes of The Night Gallery, which was like Rod Serling's show after The Twilight Zone. It was sort of a horror show in the 70s. And there was an episode where an old sea captain, I think it was like Stuart Whitman, finds a mermaid, you know, pulls up a mermaid on his boat, and he falls in love with the mermaid, and he wants to change her into an entire woman. And he finds some... witch doctor, somebody who does a spell on the mermaid, and then, you know, he sees the legs walking toward him, and he's like, oh, great, you know, and then he pulls the sheet over, and it's this giant fish woman. And I was, you know, I was like 11 when I saw that, and I was, you know, just knocked on the floor by that. And I had completely forgotten about it, and then when I saw the YouTube clip of that, I was like, oh, my God, that's where it all came from. You know, it haunted me my whole childhood.
So maybe subconsciously you wanted to inflict others with that same frightening image in there.
Maybe that's it. And it made me feel a lot better to do that.
In your new book, Patience, you get to create a sort of science fiction world. Was that fun to do, to think about what the future might look like?
Yeah, it was less fun than I wanted. Because I, you know, when I started, I thought, like, that'll be great to depict the future. And that's always fun to draw, you know, the future world. And then the more I thought about it and was trying to handle it the way I really thought it would be, it was like, the future's not going to be all that interesting. Like, I've got to sort of capture that it will be alien to us, but it will be not... I feel like it won't be as, you know, dystopic and advanced in another 15 years as we all anticipate through most of the science fiction stuff.
Dan predicts that in the future we'll all be wearing fuzzy yellow shirts, so just keep that.
That's
in mind.
Part of it. That's one of the fashion trends that I've invested a lot of money in.
Okay, I think we're going to take some questions now.
As someone that started out doing comics and then with academia and The New Yorker started doing graphic novels, how do you feel that term and its influence in the last 15 or so years, if at all, has influenced your work or how you perceive your work?
You mean the term graphic novel?
Yeah.
Oh, you know, when I can't remember when they first came up with that. It was like in the 90s or something, and we were like, oh man, we got to not do that, because you don't want people going to the store and going like, I'm going to try one of these graphic novels that I read about, and then they get it home like, it's a comic book. Come on, man, you know. And so I always tried to make it like, it's a funny book, you know, just try to sell it down to the lowest possible. And then after a while, you know, there are certain words that we hear all the time that are actually really stupid, terms that are really dumb, like the Beatles is the dumbest name for a band in the world. But we don't think about that at all, you know, and we just don't even hear. And graphic novel has become that. And I one day like found, I was like talking to some relatives or something. What are you doing? I was like, I draw graphic novels. And I was like, oh my God, did I say that? You know, and then, and now I just, you know, it's like a, it was like a clever marketing ploy. And it was actually, it actually makes sense because it, it's not a comic book, you know, it's, and it, most of, most graphic novels are not graphic novels either. They're memoirs, a lot of them.
Right. So, yeah. So you like, you prefer cartoonist, right?
As, yeah, I don't ever say like, I'm a graphic novelist, but you know, cartoonist, I don't know. There's, I always feel like it's maybe good that we don't have words for any of this stuff. Like that's, well, that's what dates things. Like my generation of cartoonists, we weren't underground cartoonists. We were like, we didn't have a name. Like people would go like alternative cartoonist or indie or, but we never had an, like an official name. And so like we never got dated. It was like, oh, that thing of the 90s. It's like, you know, grunge. If we were like grunge cartoonists, that we'd be so over. But somehow we've, you know, we've kept on just because of that.
IMDb describes you as a comic book professional. So
really?
Yes.
Like that.
Yeah, we could use that.
That was all we wanted to be when we were younger. I just want to be a pro.
I was wondering, I'm a big fan of like pulp novels and pulp fiction and things like that. Yeah. And whenever I read a lot of your earlier work, I get that feeling, a lot of similar feelings and things like that. And I was wondering, if you growing up, were you, did you read a lot of things like that, or noir movies, or
oh yeah, kind of things yeah. Like that? My both my dad and my grandpa were really into that stuff. You know, Jim Thompson. My grandpa had all Jim Thompson's paperbacks. You know, and all, you know, even Mickey Spillane, stuff like that.
I was poking around my bookshelf recently and found an old copy of Aesopus magazine and realized that your name was listed on the advisory board. Is it actually you or someone with
that is actually me. So I've never actually advised him.
I was wondering to what extent you were involved.
When the, he used to do this other magazine that I did a little strip for. He had a magazine called Public Sphere that I did something for. And when he started Aesopus, or I guess it's called Aesopus, he told me, he said, can I put you on the advisory board? You know, I'm going to ask you, you know, if you can recommend things. And I've been on there for, what, 10 years, and I've never once recommended anything. But I'm proud to be on there.
Have you seen any of them?
He sends the magazines. I really like the magazine.
So you're just a figurehead.
Totally, yeah, totally. It's like when somebody presents a movie that they have nothing to do with, you know. David Cronenberg presents, you know.
So in the run-up to this book, you've described it as being influenced by like Steve Ditko and Jack Kirby, and I guess those guys are both known for being like old cranky assholes, right?
I don't think Kirby was an asshole.
All right, yeah. I mean, like, and Wally Wood was on his way to that,
know.
And then he died.
Yeah.
And you also write a lot about old cranky guys, and so I'm wondering how aware you are of yourself as like trying to push back against that, or whether you're just letting it happen, or if you're worried about that or anything like that.
That's, you know, that's my, those are, guys are my meal tickets. That's my, you know, that's my niche. I don't know. Somebody's got to do it.
Maybe you should coin your word cranky novels.
Cranky, I'm a cranky novelist.
You talked a little bit earlier about where you were and how you started versus where you are now, and how you'd be shocked and amazed at your success. I was wondering if you could, if you had to pick one person who was most responsible for your success, who that person would be.
I would look in the mirror and say myself. No. Well, it would be George W. Bush. No, I have no idea. I don't have like a one particular person. You know, I didn't have anybody, like when I started comics, there was nobody who really like championed me or made me feel like, you know, now you're part of the inner circle. I was always felt sort of outside of that. And, you know, I've just sort of always tried to, you know, just do my own stuff. And I don't really feel like I have like somebody like that I would thank. I have a lot of close friends who all influenced me in very profound ways, but not, and there's not that one person, you know, who I can say, like, he discovered me. Celine Dion's husband, or, you know.
Do you think you're that person for anyone else?
I hope to God I'm not, because I feel like that's fraught with peril. You know, if you're like that for someone else, then later they grow to resent you and want to kill you. So, you know, I've tried not to help anybody along the way.
And that's only the best
for their own good.
I know you're responsible for collecting Nancy strips and the archival thing that went together.
How do you know that?
4 years ago?
You're reading the fine print.
Yeah. I was just curious what your collection looked like and how you got into it. Like, do you have original art or...
I wish I had a really cool story about that. I don't know. Whenever I first got eBay, the first thing I did was just look up who has old comic strips. And some lady had a few Nancy comic strips that are meticulously clipped out from the old daily newspaper for sale. And I wrote to her and said, do you have any others? And she goes, oh, I think I do. And then she wrote back and she's like, yeah, I have, like, you know, 1931 through 1976 complete. All clipped out, all wrapped in saran wrap. And I said, I want them. And so I bought them off of her. And I just assumed everybody had the complete run of Nancy. I mean, I assumed that there were other people who had better collections. I'm missing a couple years here and there. And when Fantagraphics started reprinting the old Nancy strips, Kim Thompson was saying, like, oh, we can't find any of the strips. Do you know anybody who has them? And I stupidly said, yeah, I have them all. And so if I hadn't said that, I wouldn't have to FedEx them a box every 2 years of my strips. So that's the very unglamorous story of how I have all my Nancy strips.
Considering you seem a little bit more forgiving of your early work nowadays, is there any chance of seeing any Lloyd Llewellyn reprints anytime soon?
I'm not that forgiving. I draw the line. I felt like with that stuff, that I was learning panel by panel, you know, and it's to me, it's not something I want somebody to go like, oh, this is equal to the... And nowadays people will go, I want to see his first, earliest work, and I just don't want that to be... I don't want that to speak for me somehow. Thank you, though.
Comics have changed a lot, particularly in the last 15 years, in terms of approaches to image making and what's acceptable in terms of, like, narrative and approaches to making comics. Is there anybody in the last, like, 15 years or so, or newer artists that you've been paying attention to that make you feel like you want to try different things or, you know, want to change the way that you do things?
You know, there are a lot of younger artists that I'm very inspired by and I am drawn to. You know, people like Michael DeForge and Simon Hanselman are two that really come to mind. And the thing I really want more than anything is to see work by somebody young and to feel totally inspired by that and to, like, change what I do based on that and kind of try to do something like that, and that never happens. I never feel that, like, I want to do that. I feel like, oh, it's great that they're doing it, but it's not what I want to do. And it's interesting. I'm still looking for that.
Well, you say you've been more inspired by movies and books than comics in general.
There's such a small history of comics. I feel like I've read every comic, certainly from before I started. I know pretty much everything that I would be interested right. in. You know, I mean, it's a very condensed history. And so there's certainly a lot more there in every other medium, pretty much, including candle making.
Who are your favorite non-Daniel Klaus writers, any media?
Non-Daniel Klaus writers?
Yeah.
There are no non-Daniel Klaus writers. You mean just like regular prose writers or comic writers? Oh. I don't know. It's like right now I'm in a weird phase where I just got really interested in reading like old gothic horror stuff like Nathaniel Hawthorne and I realized recently, like, I always thought I had read like H.P. Lovecraft, but I'd actually never really like made it all the way through one of his stories, and I started reading a couple of them and I was like, oh my god, these are horrifying. They're really like filled with dread, you know, and that's sort of the kind of stuff I'm interested in now. But I read a lot of like short fiction I really like that author Joy Williams a lot. She's really good. Writes these really brutal short stories about drifters in the West. In movies, I really like Charlie Kaufman is really good. I think his new movie is really a masterpiece, and I like the Coen brothers and, you know, many other older filmmakers. I'm trying to just think of people still around.
Do you enjoy writing screenplays of your work?
I sort of do. It's a good. I don't like to do it full time. It's fun for a little while. It's a really good change from doing comics, and it's something I feel sort of comfortable. I feel like I know the nuts and bolts of how to like create a drama, and and I like the fact that you can press a button and change a character's name. You can change, you know, a female character to a male character with a press of a button. I mean, in a comic, you can't change anything. You know, you could maybe change a character's name if you wanted to white it out 400 times, but you certainly can't, give a guy a different haircut all the way through a book unless you want to kill yourself. So it's I like that freedom. But then, the process of making movies is so endlessly long and boring and just filled with so many pitfalls that I just love, like, going back into my studio and just drawing comics where I don't have to care what anybody else thinks.
Well, you've described yourself as a control freak. Yeah. Is it hard for you to give up your characters to the movies?
You know, you have to develop that kind of strength. You know, you have to be able to say, like, this: I did my job. I wrote my screenplay. This is what I've done, and whatever happens from then on is out of my hands. And you know, I wish them the best, and that's it. You know, that's what you have to do. I mean, you imagine being a playwright where it's always being produced by somebody else over and over and over. You know, be like half of the time it would probably be just unbearable.
What do you think of unauthorized film adaptations of your work?
I'm a great booster of them, and I love performance art as well.
I have an image for that.
You're prepared.
I'm prepared. Hold on. It'll get there in a second.
Oh, man. That's not something I wanted to have to see. To me, the only really bad thing about the whole thing was just that, like, now I could never Google myself without our two names being linked.
I'll change the slide now.
Thank you. Thank you.
I saw an interview with you where you were saying how you were amazed at how, in comics, how the line was so perfect, and you thought it was, like, you know, done by a computer, and then you realize it was all hand-painted.
Yeah.
And then you strive to kind of get there. Do you think you reached a point with your technique where you, like, hit a plateau? Was there, like, a book or a moment in time where you thought, like, I've mastered my craft, or are you still, like, pushing yourself?
You know, it's an endless process that goes through these cycles of me feeling like I've done it, I've finally got it. You know, this is exactly what I want it to look like. And then I'll walk away for a few days and I'll look at it again and I'll go, oh my God, this looks like a 4-year-old drew this thing. And sometimes I'll think, like, I'm really drawing as good as, like, the people I was inspired by when I was young. You know, I've finally gotten to that point. And then I'll look at their work, often like old guys who are drawing comics when they're 20, 25 years old, that are, like, unbelievably better than anything I could ever do. And then I have to, like, okay, I got to really refocus and get back to doing it. And so I really always feel like I need about 25 more years of work. So, you know, maybe when I'm 80.
Well, I'm going to piggyback on that, because you said in Modern Cartoonist that cartoonists should be doing their best work probably in their 40s and 50s.
Well, because it was 15 or 20 years away.
Well, how do you feel? Do you feel like you're doing your best work now?
I mean, I always feel like every last thing is the best thing, but then, you know, then you look at it all and when it's all behind you, and it, I don't know, none of it seems better or worse at all. I always feel like I put in my effort into everything, and that's all I can do, and you can't really judge them. It's like judging kids.
Well, you can judge kids.
Yeah, but you can't judge your own kids. I like that one, but that one was a big disappointment.
Great. Well, thanks very much.
Thanks for putting up with my coughing fit.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.